The Bloodstream podcast is made possible by Takeda and is intended for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. Please consult with professionals before making any healthcare decisions.
I suspect pretty high level of certainty that every argument they use will be actually proven wrong with the actual data.
That voice belongs to Colette Koulianos, the Senior Director of Payer Relations at the National Hemophilia Foundation. She joins Amy and I a little later in the show to discuss the results of an NHF-driven survey titled, wait for it, the National Registered Voter Sentiment on Patient Copay Assistance Programs, or NRVSPCAP. That acronym is not real. But the survey is, and a whopping 86% of the 1,000 registered voters surveyed were in agreement. On what? Colette will explain in just a little bit. William Addison joins us today as well. He's a high schooler from Maine with severe hemophilia A, whose fundraising trek of the Appalachian Trail he hoped would raise just over $2,000 for Save One Life. Well, William raised more than 10 times that amount, bringing in over $25,000 for the global NGO. He joins us after Colette to talk about his outstanding accomplishments. All that, plus Natalie's back, Alex Dowsett's in the news again, and the WFH's General Assembly has come to a conclusion with the appointment of a new president. We'll get into it all here in just a moment, but before we do, let me first just say to you, hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast. I'm your bleeder host, Patrick James Lynch, joined as I am each week by my bleed-free colleague and competitive wiffle ball teammate, not true, Amy Board. Hello, Amy.
That's right, I'm bleed-free, but I still have, like, nosebleeds and things like that. Just like
blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
I have
blood in your body.
Yeah. I have an adequate amount of factor eight. I wonder how much though, honestly. Since I'm in this biz, honest to God, I should get a free test. Good grief.
And joining us, she does on the fourth Friday of each month, Bloodstream host, professional doula, and my roommate, Natalie Lynch. Hi, Natalie, and welcome back to Bloodstream. We missed you these last few weeks.
Thank you. I've been busy growing a baby. And I bleed too.
You bleed too. We all bleed, don't we? Well, a lot to get to amongst bleeding and other stuff. We have two interviews, a variety of topics. I want to tell you about our special Halloween episode next week. And of course, none of any of this all would be possible without the support of Bloodstream's presenting sponsor, Takeda. Rooted in over 230 years of rich history in Japan, Takeda is relentless in their commitment to what they call a bleed-free world. Well, we have something to say about that. And you can learn more about Takeda's commitment to and resources for the bleeding disorders community by visiting Takeda's website at bleedingdisorders.com. Bloodstream would not be possible without Takeda's support, and for that, we say thanks, Takeda.
Thank you, Takeda.
Thanks, Takeda.
So before we start talking for real, and actually for real, I just want to tell everyone about the Halloween special we have coming up next week, because I feel like it's going to be a really big deal.
I go right ahead. I agree.
So we've been hyping this for a while, that we have like new podcasts coming out, and this is the first one. It's called Haunting Season, and to tell you the truth, Patrick, I can't wait for our listeners to hear the story behind it, because there is a long, multi-yeared YouTube channel story behind this. This isn't like a new phenomenon, but our creative director and photographer and bearded human that works for Believe, Joshua Sterling Bragg, is going to be with us next week to talk all things spooky, scary with Haunting Season. And he's just a delightful human, so I can't wait to have him on. Like, it's just going to be... it's going to be a hoot and a holler, as I say.
Is it about scary bleeds?
Not necessarily,
maybe.
But yeah, that's the thing. Josh's creative imagination can really run rampant. So I won't say it's not about creative bleeds. It might be about creepy bleeds. It could very easily be. And if you have a creepy bleed story that you'd like us to mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com.
Oh my gosh, please.
I mean, Halloween is the bloodiest holiday.
Oh, for sure. I think there's like a lot of data to support that.
There is, yeah, a lot of, and many films. I've seen a lot of films on the topic, a lot of blood in those films.
There's a certain specific type of person that like loves horror films and like the horror genre. And I feel like this is the show for them.
What kind of, how would you describe said person, Amy? Just, you know, out of curiosity, asking for a friend.
I feel like this is a setup because I am not one of those people. And I feel like if I describe those people, it'll be like I'm judging them. And I'm not. Horror films just freak me out, man.
Judge away. I'm not one of those people either, but we might have one in this group.
Well, look, I think the big point here is if you're not already subscribed to Bloodstream on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, that would be a great time to do so, so that you don't miss next week's Mischief Night and Halloween special with Mr. Joshua Sterling Bragg. We're also going to share some audio from Josh and Haunting Season a little bit later in the pod, so keep an ear out for that. Natalie, you will not be joining us today for that interview that we're going to be doing with William, because while we're doing that, you are going to be on a board call for Save One Life, the organization that William's efforts are raising money for, as you are a board member. Regular listeners are, of course, familiar with Save One Life. I think it would be interesting for people to hear some updates from one of its board members. So maybe if you could, and if you wouldn't mind, and if you're at liberty to share a little bit about what's going on at Save One Life these days.
I'm absolutely at liberty to. So Save One Life, we're in the third quarter. It's the board meeting today. Super exciting. And all major fundraisers for Save One Life have been completed in this year. And we did really, really well. The first one this year was the At Home Everest Challenge. I'm sure you've seen it if you're on social media. Patrick and I ran up the stairs a lot. There were over 100 donations totaling $14,000. It was a really, really successful fundraiser, and it was really fun. And then Wheels for the World was our September Barry Hardy honored ride, and it was virtual for most people. We had 154 riders, which was over double last year, and raised over $50,000. And then we'll be speaking to William Addison later, but he intended to raise $2,000 for Save One Life, and he raised over $25,000 with 125 unique donors. So I'm really, really, really excited. I won't be a part of that interview, but I cannot wait to hear about his experience. So a really successful year of fundraising for Save One Life. And what I'd like to mention is our sponsorships. So this year with COVID, everyone who's been sponsoring a kid has continued for the most part. So COVID hasn't affected Save One Life in that way, but it has affected the sponsee families. So lockdown in the different countries has caused a lot of the parents to be out of work. And really then the sponsorship bringing the income into the family for the basic needs. So it feels like right now, if you can sponsor another child or a first child, that would be really, really good, because for some people, this is the only source of money coming into the family. On the website, we actually had some of our program partners write in how impactful the sponsorships have been during this time. And I just want to read one about this little boy named Brian. In March, the rains in Kenya caused flooding and devastation. Brian's home was flooded and his family's crops were destroyed. A neighbor took the family in until the house was clear of flood water. Brian's parents work as laborers on local farms, but due to COVID-19, the farms were closed, resulting in them losing all of their income. The family has planted new crops on their land, and Brian's parents will use the crops to feed their family. Without the support, Brian and his family would have had zero funds for basic necessities. The sponsorship program is Brian's safety net, especially during these tough times. To me, I mean, and we have a lot of different updates on specific kids and how the funds during this time were instrumental in these families being able to get by. So if you have it in your heart and in your pocketbook to sponsor a kid right now, Save One Life would be really, really appreciative of that.
Well, thank you. That's really good to know. It's nice to hear that in spite of the topsy-turvy COVID year, that from a fundraising perspective, that there's, I mean, I'm sure things were adjusted and had to be shifted, but it sounds like there's excitement and positivity around what was able to be accomplished in a most challenging year. So that's super encouraging.
Overall, Save One Life, with the help of a lot of donors, were able to take care of a lot of kids this year.
Well, that's really, really cool. So again, saveonelife.net/sponsorships. If you would like to sponsor a child or just give to Save One Life generally, there are a number of different ways you can do so. So saveonelife.net for more on that. And last thing that I want to bring up, just before we jump into the discussion about this survey and bring Colette in, British cyclist Little Bleeders founder and, yes, fellow with hemophilia, Alex Dowsett, secured a critical cycling victory earlier this month on Stage 8 of Italy's Giro d'Italia. I know zero about professional cycling, never mind European professional cycling, but for a little bit of context, this was written on October 10th, the day of Alex's victory, also World Mental Health Day, on cyclingnews.com. Wins have rarely been as timely as Saturday's victory for Alex Dowsett on Stage 8 of the Giro d'Italia, as the British racer soloed to Israel startup nation's biggest ever triumph in the team's seven-year history. That's the team he was racing with. Didn't even know you raced with a team. Without a team for 2021 and soon to be a father, hey, Dowsett's victory is also of massive personal significance as the British rider seeks to continue his career in the World Tour. A stage win in Italy's Grand Tour, the second of his career, has undoubtedly placed the 32-year-old in the virtual shop window for teams looking for riders. Given the instant and considerable raising of his profile thanks to Saturday's win, the British time trial champion and former UCI Hour record holder reflected wryly afterwards that it was, quote, kind of a shame that my biggest feeling as I crossed the line was not joy, but one of relief, as I'm out of contract for 2020. I love that. That's like so honest and practical. And it's like, what truth, right? It really is never about the finish line, because at the finish line, you're just like, oh, thank God I can get another contract. It really is about the journey, folks. So congrats, Alex. That's awesome. And I can only imagine that it has set you up very well for a 2021 contract. So go get it. And sticking with the international point of view, last point here, the WFH mentioned earlier had their general assembly recently that saw Alain Veil complete his second and final mandate as president of the WFH. Huh, term limits. Congratulations to Alain and the WFH for all that was accomplished during his watch. There is a lovely article on Alain on WFH.org for those interested. Likewise, if you'd like to learn more about the new president, Venezuela's Cesar Garrido? I think it might be Garrido. G-A-R-R-I-D-O. I obviously don't know how to pronounce his last name, but if you would like to learn more about him, there's a nice Q&A that you can read. It won't help with pronunciations, but you can read it, that WFH CEO Elaine Bauman did with him a couple of years ago. So you can find that by searching Cesar's name on the WFH website, or you can simply follow the link in the program notes. All right, so now that all that has been said, Amy, I want to get into the survey conversation, copay assistance programs, and what registered voters are apparently overwhelmingly voting in favor of. But before we get into that, Natalie, I understand that you have an important message for us.
Yes, why thank you, Patrick. I want to let listeners know that this segment was made possible by our segment sponsor, Genentech.
Oh, sure, yeah, that's an important message.
And Genentech wants the world to know that the hemophilia community has game.
Well, I could have told you that. I bagged you, didn't I?
Not that kind of game. No, you didn't bag anyone, and ew.
Yeah, ew.
Yeah, that's fair. That's really, sorry.
Introducing a new game, The Bloodless Battle, the first ever hemophilia esports event on Twitch Rivals, brought to you by Genentech. Watch heme gamers duke it out in an epic showdown. The event will be hosted by celebrity magician Justin Willman, who will try to keep sweating to a minimum.
Oh, that actually means I will certainly not be playing, as my sweating is almost never at a minimum.
That's also ew, but true. The Bloodless Battle takes place December 1st, and you can click the link in the program notes for the full schedule. And remember, there's more for the hemophilia community to see at genentechhemophilia.com.
So everybody, raise your hand if you've heard about copay accumulator adjustment programs. Ugh. Everyone's raising their hand. And I can feel listeners at home raising your hand because we've talked extensively about this. If you have not heard about copay accumulator adjustment programs, we have a fantastic Ask the Expert episode with our guest today, Kuliette Koulianos, actually, that you can go back through the archives and find. She gives a tremendous overview on what these programs are. But basically, if you use copay cards to access your clotting factor, and right now, I would love to hear some stories of people that do not use copay cards, but basically these cards go towards your deductible or your out-of-pocket max in order to access your clotting factor. And as we know, clotting factor is so expensive, so those percentages of what you would owe as a family could be potentially very, very high. If you have to pay 45% of your month-long dose, that could be thousands and thousands of dollars. So these copay cards are essential to making sure that clotting factor is accessible to our patients. And what's happening is the insurance companies, due to a cost control measure, I mean, they're really trying to control costs. They don't really necessarily understand small, ultra-rare diseases like hemophilia. They are accessing these programs, these accumulator programs, that these copay cards do not count towards the patient's sliver of what they owe in terms of their out-of-pocket max. So you could, if you, you know, use these copay cards, use it in January, use it up, and then in April you could be hit with a surprise bill. So they are, this is an issue that the National Hemophilia Foundation and Colette have been working on really extensively, but now gearing up for a new administration. This election, the National Hemophilia Foundation has taken the lead on this survey to get kind of an idea of what registered voters actually think about these programs, what they think about their out-of-pocket max costs and how that affects them and their family. And so we can't wait to have Colette come on and share a little bit about what the survey found and what are some next steps going forward.
That was a really, really great overview. Thank you, Amy. I have no questions about that. Natalie, do you have any questions about any of that?
No, I mean, I would be surprised that this doesn't affect literally everyone in the community. I mean, it's really, really important.
I agree. And a lot of times, issues that affect like the chronic disease community sometimes don't filter down to specifically the hemophilia community. And this particular issue is just, it's so invaluable to our community.
Well, let's bring in Colette and talk more about it.
Before we close out for the survey segment and bring Colette on, we want to once again thank Genentech for being a Bloodstream segment sponsor this month. Remember to watch the Bloodless Battle on Twitch Rivals. See the full schedule by clicking the link in the program notes.
Amy, Nat, and I are going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Colette.
Patrick and I are here with Colette Koulianos. Colette is the Senior Director of Payer Relations at the National Hemophilia Foundation, which is a mouthful of a title and yet extremely accurate.
The role was created when I joined NHF almost 5 years ago, and that's really working with payers across the country in whatever, capacity, whatever bucket they fall into, whether it's public or private, self-insured, self-funded or partially funded or fully funded plans to make sure that patients have access to care.
We're excited to have you back on the podcast. You've been here on Ask the Expert actually talking about accumulator programs. So we're excited to kind of continue that journey.
Yeah, though someday we'll have you on for something else. Someday we'll find a different topic to talk with you about, but that day will not be today. So we obviously want to talk about the study, the results, and get into that. But can you first just tell us why NHF commissioned this study in the first place, and how did that process get started?
Right. So we actually have been intimately involved with the copay accumulator issue since the first copay accumulator was identified, right? And so having watched from the end of 2016 when we learned of the programs that we're going to start on a self-funded plan in January of 2017 till today, and seeing that we're somewhere above 50% of all commercially insured folks have an accumulator adjuster on their health plan. So a very rapid implementation of these strategies that payers are deploying that are very short-sighted, if I might say, because they're being rolled out as a one-size-fits-all. And so in the case of hemophilia, and frankly other chronic and rare diseases where there's no generic alternative, where this is high-value, high-cost treatments, mm-hmm. so life and death for our community, mm-hmm. to put an obstacle in the way from a patient being able to obtain that medication leaves the patient vulnerable, right? And the cost to the patient is extreme and can be even death if they don't have access to their treatment and they have a major organ bleed. But the cost to the health plan, while they think they're driving savings, they actually will end up forcing the patient into the higher cost of care settings, which is the emergency room or hospital-owned infusion centers, rather than being able to self-infuse at home. And so it's this growth of these plans that continues to catapult us into taking action. As I think you guys know, I helped start the All Copays Count Coalition with colleagues from the Arthritis Foundation, AIDS Institute, MS, cancer, and kidney, the Kidney Fund. Mm-hmm. And we now have some 80 some member organizations that are participating or members of the All Copays Count Coalition. And so we've tried to work on a federal and state level using that avenue. But what we realize is that the only way to really get the point out there is going to be to actually have facts that speak against what the proponents use as their arguments to implement these programs. And so they talk about it doesn't affect that many people, they still have the ability to get their meds. The problem isn't what they're trying to make it sound like. So that's the reason for getting the survey out. The second part of what we're doing is we're commissioning an actuarial study, because the other big argument is if we don't implement copay accumulators, the cost to health plans is much greater because patients are using these coupons. They're being used by the manufacturers to take these coupons and drive them to the highest cost of care. Highest cost products, and instead of the generic. Well, the fact is these programs target 80-some percent of the drugs they target have no generics, like in our world. And they're available for every product on the market. So it's not driving patients to a higher cost.
No, so that's a pretty hollow argument. I want to just clarify one thing you mentioned, looking at actuary study? I didn't quite catch the word, and I'm not sure what that is.
An actuarial study. So NHF actually commissioned an actuarial study several years ago when we were trying to get the lifetime caps raised. And, because at that time the argument from the proponents of having lower lifetime caps was that the cost to the health plans, the cost to the people paying for the health care. And so we commissioned a study, and they used PricewaterhouseCooper at the time, to actually do an actuarial study, taking a deep dive into the data to either confirm that argument or to deny it with facts. And so that's what we're doing with the accumulator. We have an RFP we're writing now to try to, at first to identify which organizations will answer the RFP and then choose an organization that we will commission to do the actuarial study. That's going to take a deep dive on, is this really the argument, is it pushing patients to higher cost products? Is it raising the cost to health plans if they don't implement the accumulator? What is the cost burden of not having an accumulator to a plan? And I suspect pretty high level of certainty that every argument they use will be actually proven wrong with the actual data.
Wow. Good.
Awesome. Yeah.
So can you tell us a little about what data came out of this study? What's most important for patients and families to take away from this study?
Well, so we have an election coming up. So one of the things that was first and foremost was let's get a study done, because remember, back in April of 2019, CMS and CSIO issued what's known as the National Benefit and Payment Parameters. It was the NBPP 2020, which was a final rule that said no health plans, and that included self-funded ERISA plans, no health plans could put a copay accumulator on if there was no generic. So that was a victory for us and for most of the communities that are being targeted with these programs. that was a short-lived victory, because before it was actually even implemented, right, that was April 2019, it was to start the plan year 2020. By August of 2019, they walked that back and said that there was argument. People who are proponents for these programs say that it's a violation of IRS HSA guidelines to allow patients to use this assistance when they have an HSA, a health savings account. Now, that was the reason that they walked it back. We waited from August of 2019 until May of this year for the 2021 rule to come out, and the response was health plans can implement an accumulator if they want to. So while I'm not a lawyer, to me that answers the fact that it's not against IRS, because if it was, they would say you can't. And also, I mean, frankly, listen, how many times have you seen, and I'm not picking on St. Jude, it's obviously a wonderful organization. Every day, practically, there's a St. Jude commercial that comes on that says no one ever receives a bill. They get what they get from the insurance, and no patient will receive a bill. Well, if you have an HSA, what, you don't get a bill. So that's that argument, it doesn't hold ground for me. However, that's the rule we have. You know, that's the rule we live with. There is, I will tell you, since COVID started, there is currently a bipartisan bill that has 32 bipartisan signers that are co-sponsoring this legislation. While I agree it's heavily Democrat, there are Republicans on it, though, which gives me it gives me hope. And that's saying, because of COVID, let's remove the NBPP 2021. Let's pause its implementation and go back to the original intent of the 2020 language until a year after COVID. So because obviously there's the financial economic burden of COVID. So that is gaining momentum. Hopefully we get some progress there. And then, of course, the Medicaid best price rule that came out, they added accumulator language there as well, which, you know, again, it's not our battle, certainly not our battle to fight for pharmaceutical companies, but our fear is if there's a risk to pharmaceutical companies throwing their hands in the air and saying we just aren't going to do these programs, that patients are going to be the ones who get you know, the burden and get caught in the middle of that. So that's where we have to keep the fight going.
And so this study, the findings from this study is really, you are hoping that this will add strength to arguments as we go forward with like the next administration. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
Whether it's the current administration, right, which is clearly a Republican administration, and I'm agnostic, other than I care about patients, and I'm not here to say which side of the aisle I sit on. I could care less what anybody sits on. This is a fact. This is a healthcare facts, right? So we currently have a Republican administration, and so what I didn't want is any data to be challenged by either party. You know that this you only interviewed just patients who were affected, or you only interviewed just Republicans or just Democrats. So we launched this survey to the general population of registered voters. So you had to be over 18, you had to be a registered voter. And we wanted to make sure that we had captured, you know, equality on both sides of the aisle, men and women of different age groups and different, you know, physical localities. And, you know, what the study told us, the big takeaway, and I think important as this election comes up, is that both Republicans and Democrats strongly feel that the federal government should insist that the assistance a patient receives counts to their out-of-pocket. You know, so what I can say is, you know, 83%, I believe, of Republicans strongly agreed, 83% of independents, 91% of Democrats. So greater than 80% strongly believe across parties, or some total 86% believe, you know, however you want to slice and dice the data. But we have strong support on both sides of the aisle for this issue. And so as our legislators whoever they may be after this election, they need to understand loud and clear what the American voters feel as they reconsider the NBPP, hoping to get additional signers as a result of the of this findings. I mean, that for me is would be a big win. And then, you know, from a state level, which we've doubled down our state work, we currently have anti-accumulator bills in Virginia, which was first, West Virginia, Arizona, Illinois, now Georgia, and the recent, most recent, Puerto Rico. So I know Ohio is currently considering, there's several states that have anti-accumulator language proposed as we go into the next government cycle in those states. And so we're hoping to use this data, regardless of which party is in the lead, to understand how the American voters feel.
That's great. It leads to my next question. We have so many listeners that are engaged advocates that kind of live and breathe this stuff. Do you anticipate and envision our advocates, our bleeding disorder advocates, utilizing this data as we go forward in the next year?
Yeah, I absolutely hope they do. If they're gonna, rally together on a state level and collaborate with other disease groups to try to get action in the state level, they should use this data. When answering the survey, those who identified themselves with a chronic disease of some sort, now that could have been any, you know, any chronic disease, it was over 40% said that had a chronic disease that say they or someone in their family could not afford their out-of-pocket costs this last year. Now, we specifically asked about the six diseases that our steering committee represents. So cancer, MS, HIV, hemophilia, autoimmune diseases. We specifically asked if they had one of those conditions. And of the respondents who had one of those conditions, over 51% had not been able to afford their out-of-pocket costs. And so over this last year, I mean, there's no question COVID has impacted our economy. 49% of Americans in a recent survey said that their income had been affected as a result of COVID. So the matter was already a problem before COVID, and now we have COVID meets accumulator equals catastrophe. So,
yeah, that's a terrible equation. So from a process standpoint, what happens next, whether Republican or Democrat, the next administration? What are the next milestones or big steps that people should keep an eye out for on this issue?
Well, I mean, we're doing another survey. This time we're going to aim it just to the chronic disease communities, right? So we have the balanced on both sides. And we're going to launch that survey hopefully in the next couple of weeks. The results won't be in before our election cycle, but it certainly will be beneficial as states go into session to be able to use that at a state level. And so I'm going to, you know, hope that folks like yourself help promote that everybody who gets a link to that survey make sure to take the moment to take it, because the data is critical for us to be able to tell the story. And obviously, the actuarial study will be very impactful. I mean, when I speak to some of the state senators across the country and state reps that I've been fortunate to be invited to speak with, you know, they want to know the impact to their state. And they want to know, how do we argue against the proponents of these programs that come in and tell us it's costing more if we don't do this? So that's why the actuarial study is pretty important.
Colette, thanks for joining us today and sharing all of this information. It's really important, and it's kind of behind the scenes. You know, I know so many people are personally affected by this and have dealt with the day-to-day fight with their own insurance companies, and it's been a nightmare. And to know that there is not only statewide, but a national response to this, and hearing about the wheels being turned, I know it's like plugging so many different holes, but thank you so much for doing the work that you do and for joining us today.
Yep, you bet. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, guys. Thanks.
When I was a kid,
I used to be terrified of the attic. It was dark and cold and creaky, and I just knew there was some sort of ghost up there. But I would still climb the stairs and see how long I could last before running back into the light and diving under the safe armor of my bedsheets. As I got older, that game got a lot less fun. It feels like the older you get, the more things make you afraid, and the deeper that feeling of scared actually gets. But there's still some fun to be had. That's what my show Haunting Season is all about. It's a weekly show, and we talk about some of the darkest mysteries of the visible and invisible world. Once a month, my co-host Cody and I pick a common fear, we dissect it, and discuss it with an author. The rest of the month is filled with original short scary stories based on that theme. If you're someone like me who still enjoys facing the dark from time to time, or you're curious if anyone out there has a shared experience with something that just doesn't fit into a textbook, then I think you'd like our show. Haunting Season is available everywhere you listen to podcasts, and we have a video version on YouTube and Facebook. Check it out. It's a lot of fun.
All right, Amy and I are joined now by Will Addison. Will, welcome. Thanks for coming on the Bloodstream podcast.
Yeah, appreciate you taking the time.
You're like a celebrity now. You're an official bleeding disorder celebrity now. Up with the status of Patrick James Lynch and Chris Bombardier.
I don't know about that, but okay.
So, well, speaking of taking the time, I mean, you chose something that is quite time intensive. So before we get into like a whole lot of what's happened the last number of months, I want to go back to where did this idea first come from? I know you were inspired by your Boy Scout work and looking toward the Eagle Scouts, but why the trail? Why save one life?
So actually, funny story. The initial idea for hiking the AT was not actually my idea. My buddy actually he came up with it, and he's 18 now, but he didn't do it. So I went solo. But he, you know, we were riding the bus. I think I was in like 7th or 8th grade, maybe 8th grade probably. He's like, "Hey, do you want to hike the AT?" And so I said, "That sounds really fun," because obviously I'd done some backpacking in Boy Scouts, and I thought it was really cool. And I initially thought I could do something with it, and I just thought Save One Life was a really great kind of benefactor for my raising money, because I knew I wanted to raise money for some kind of organization, and Save One Life just kind of fit really well with what I wanted to raise money for.
And you had wanted to, Amy, I already violated what we talked about, and you had wanted to, I know, initially raise, I believe it was $2,200, and we'll get to where that went. Where did that number come from?
So the Appalachian Trail, the exact mileage of it is 2,193. It changes, so, you know, it's commonly referred to as like 2,200 miles. So I thought, you know, a dollar a mile, that would be really awesome if I could raise a dollar a mile, 2,200.
You know, I think a lot of people, maybe with the memoir Wild and the movie Wild, kind of understand what maybe through hiking is like. But like, walk us through a little bit about what through hiking means. How long were you on the trail? What did you have to carry in your pack? What did you have to prepare for, you know, beforehand? You know, tell our audience a little bit about what it's like to through hike.
Sure. So there's no real definition onto, you know, the term through hike. It's pretty loose. But basically a through hike is just going out into the woods, and hiking a trail is pretty much what it is. So there's tons of trails out there. The Appalachian Trail is definitely a through hike. It's over 2,000 miles. And basically you just kind of walk all day, and you carry your own food, and you have to carry basically, you know, everything that you need to kind of survive. And so most people have between like a 20 and 40 pound pack. I had probably just under 30, or right around 30 pounds, which was pretty average depending on how much food and water I was carrying. So you know, just the basic stuff when you're backpacking, hiking, camping, you got, you know, matches, compass, you know, your big 10 in Boy Scouts, we call them, which is basically your stuff to survive. And then obviously I had to carry Factor. And then, you know, extra clothes if I wanted to. In the beginning, I carried a full extra change of clothes. You carry a pair of hiking clothes and a pair of clothes you wear in camp. And then, you know, sleeping stuff, a tent, quilt, a down quilt, which is lighter than a sleeping bag. And then an inflatable pad to keep you all warm and away from the rain. Basically just, you know, stuff to keep you alive.
And now I'm going to violate our agreement, Patrick. But did you shift things like during the hike, during that long hike? Did you figure out like, oh, this was too much weight? Like, tell us a little bit about that journey.
Sure. So in the beginning, when I started in Maine, I started June 5th. I started with a pretty heavy pack. So my dad had pretty much done all the research and packing for the Boy Scout stuff. So he was the one who had all the gear and knew everything. And so eventually over time I kind of learned. And by the time I thru-hiked, I had the same gear as, he picked out for me. And, I kind of learned what I needed and didn't need. So eventually I got rid of my camp shoes. So the only pair of shoes I had were the ones I was wearing. I just kind of whittled down my gear. Eventually, I became more like focused on weight. You don't want to carry more than you have to, especially over the course of, 4 months, a pound of weight is a lot. So, I got rid of my stove, which is kind of excessive, but you really want to get down your weight, which really helped with the physical challenge, I guess.
Will, Ellen M., we had put out on Facebook if people had some questions, and a few good questions came in. Ellen M. Asked, at one point your dad joined you. What was that like after not seeing your family during all that time? And that kind of leads me too to think, how long were stretches where you were kind of on your own? And then to her question, what was it like when your dad joined you?
So I think the only stretch he joined me for was the last like half mile to Springer Mountain, or the last mile. He hiked with me up, from the mile one parking lot to mile zero Springer Mountain. It was only about 500 feet of elevation gain. So it wasn't a lot. It was nice to have a hiking partner. I did have a few hiking partners over the course of my hike, only really two different times over like 35 miles-ish. But what was the rest of your question? Sorry.
Well, just in general, like how much time would you spend by yourself? So if you had other hiking partners at times, how often were you by yourself? What were those stints like?
Okay. So I was by myself all the time. I didn't have any consistent hiking partner. So by myself, I guess I would like run into North Boundaries. Usually in last North Boundary I saw was in Virginia, and the first I saw was kind of in Southern Maine. So they're pretty spread out, but.
And sorry, what's a North Bounder?
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. So I'm a South Bounder. I started on the Northern Terminus and I hiked south to Springer Mountain. And then North Bounder starts at Springer Mountain and hikes north to Katahdin.
Got it.
It's just whichever way you're going, just kind of a name.
And the South Bound is more rare, right? Most people start south and go up.
Yeah. So it's like, I think it's some crazy number, like 95% of hikers are North Bounders.
Wow,
why?
I don't know. At this point, it's kind of just tradition. At this point, there's just more people doing it, and people kind of come out for the experience of being with other thru-hikers and having a trail family, which is basically, a group of people you hike with for a long time. So, if you want that kind of experience, you don't really want to go southbound because there's no guarantee that you'll get a hiking partner.
Did you meet cool people? Tell us a little bit about the people that you met and kind of like a story that stood out to you.
Sure. So most of my hiking was in like Appalachia. So there are quite a few characters out. There's a very diverse kind of group of people that are through hikers. So you meet a whole bunch of people. I guess a funny story is, my dad put this up on his own Facebook page because I don't know if he could put it up on the Sobo for Saving Life one, but in Vermont, I met this guy who was wearing a MAGA hat and like nothing else except his shoes and a pair of underwear. Super nice guy. He was like, hey, do you need anything? I've got extra food if you need extra food, because sometimes people run out. And then out of the blue, he just asked me if I wanted some acid, because apparently he has acid. So that was interesting, especially at the time I was 15 years old. So that's kind of my story whenever people ask about the kind of people you meet.
You'll never forget that guy.
If someone's wearing underwear, shoes or sneakers, flip-flops even, regardless of what hat they're wearing, if they're like, hey, do you need anything? The answer is always no. I think, in fact, that guy could use some clothes.
It's a life lesson.
Thru hikers are always very nice people. The bad interactions you have on trail are generally day hikers or just people you meet, you know, crossing a road or whatever. Thru hikers are, I haven't met a bad thru hiker. But actually down the trail, I was also in Vermont, and this other thru hiker, she said, I was talking with her in a shelter whenever I was kind of done for the day hiking. And I was talking with her, and I told her about this because I thought it was really funny. And she's like, yeah, I know that guy. I forget what she said his trail name was, which is a name you get just for on trail. You don't really go by your real name. But he said, you know, she said he was like a really nice guy, and he wasn't actually like a big politics or Trump supporter. He just wanted to wear it just for like laughs or a reaction or something. So
what a character.
A lot of weird people out there, but they're all very nice people.
What were... So you mentioned, like, sometimes if you have a negative interaction, it's more likely to be a day hiker or somebody you bump into. Did you have any either what we'd call negative interactions or any days where there was a particularly outstanding challenge before you?
Not really. I wouldn't say I had any negative interactions. Everyone out there is really nice, so it's kind of weird to meet someone who's, like, not nice, kind of standoffish or something like that. But I didn't meet anyone with, you know... you know, we all have bad days, and that really sucks, and it can reflect on how you, you know, talk with other people or meet other people. And but, you know, you don't really meet bad people out there. That it's weird to find a bad or mean person out on trail.
What did you learn about yourself when you found, you know, I mean, I imagine you found yourself feeling fatigued or feeling over it, you know, just wanting, you know, a hamburger for heaven's sakes. What did you learn about yourself in those moments of adversity in those 4 months? 4 months, man.
Sure. So, you know, a hamburger, you go into town kind of often. So you just kind of look forward to the next resupply, the next town. But as far as adversity goes, I guess I really learned, you know, whenever stuff really sucks and you're having a really hard time and it's horrible, you have to be able to kind of hype yourself up and, you know, keep hiking, which was a challenge. I didn't really, you know, that was something I learned throughout the whole AT. I didn't just instantly learn it, which shows in Virginia. I was super unmotivated and I didn't really hike that much. But over the course of the 4 months, I definitely learned how to kind of get myself going and get up in the morning and look forward to things instead of kind of looking at the hiking as like a burden. It's like, why am I out here? And one of the, I guess, famous quotes out on trail is, which is really meaningful and a great quote, is you never quit on a bad day. You go into town, you get a hotel, a hostel, a room, and a large pizza, and then you decide if you want to quit.
You know, I love that. My co-founder at Believe, Ryan Geelan, is a fan of saying never quit on a hill. And I think that came from a football experience. And I've often thought of that sometimes literally when I've been on a hill, hiking, running, or biking, and been like, you can't quit now. This is literally what the quote is. So I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. What did keep you, and this also John D. asked about this with regard to like that mental drive and the days where you just weren't feeling it. What did keep you pushing forward? So what would be that thing that helped you when you got out of bed, like, I can't do this? What did you come back to that kept you moving?
Sure. So, you know, in the 2 year research planning period before I set foot on trail, you kind of learn people, you know, their bad days. And, you know, when you're out on trail, you kind of have to realize like, wow, I'm really out here doing this. And even on a bad day, when it's raining and you're cold, shivering, and you've got 20 more miles to do, you know, you just kind of, I kind of realize like, this is what I came out here to do. I'm not quitting. And then, of course, there's the added accountability that the Facebook page kind of gave me. And then stopping would be, I don't know, kind of selfish, I guess, in that other people are following and I'm raising money for this great organization. Why would I stop? So if it really came down to it, I could think, you know, why would I stop? I'm helping other people. But it very, very rarely ever came to that. I had a lot of fun out there, and it was... We all have bad days, but like I said, you learn how to deal with them and you can get over them kind of quickly.
Tell us about your favorite sunrise or sunset moment.
Okay. So on the trail, there are fire towers on top of mountains. They're not really used anymore by the Forest Service. So talking with through other through hikers, I kind of got the impression that you always want to try and like sleep in a fire tower whenever you can, because it's like really awesome. You can see the stars, especially when you're kind of out there a little bit in the woods. There's no light pollution, so you can really see the stars. And I was in Vermont actually, and I could still see the White Mountains. And I woke up in this fire tower, and there was a huge undercast, which is, there's clouds, you know, you can't see anything except for the mountains rising up out of them. And then the sun was coming up in the distance, and it was really awesome. It was like 360 panoramic view, just nothing you could see but the mountaintops. It was awesome.
That's a pretty beautiful picture you just painted. You know, you mentioned the Facebook page a few minutes ago. And, well, actually, quick question before my actual question. Sobo, is that your trail name? You mentioned trail nicknames earlier. I've been wondering that this whole time. I'm sure it's like somewhere, and I probably read it too and don't even remember. But where does Sobo come from?
Sure. So Sobo is shortening of southbound. Like, you call northbounders Nobo and southbounders Sobo. It's just like a shorter version of southbound. And my trail name is Hats Off, which I can explain the story if you want.
Yes, I would like you to do that.
Yeah, we can't go forward without it.
It's a good story. So in Maine, I was just south of the 100-mile wilderness, which is basically a 100-mile section where there's no major road crossings. There's dirt roads. I think you cross one very rural paved road. Anyway, it was just past Monson, which is the southern end of it, which is a town. And in that section, you're kind of hopping dirt or logging road to logging road. They're just dirt roads and kind of crappy. They're not paved. And so in this one section between roads, or really dirt paths, I should say, they're not really roads. There's a hawk, and it's kind of territorial. And so at that time I was hiking with a hat. And so this hawk was really mad. It seemed like it was just angry. It was making a lot of noise. It was flying around, and I saw it go off to my left. And I was like, huh, well, I guess I just should just keep hiking. It might be mad because I'm in its space or something like that. And so it kind of made its presence known to me, and it flew behind me, and I didn't think anything of it because I'd actually hiked that section a couple summers ago, and so I was kind of familiar with it and never had a bad interaction with an animal before, a wild animal. And so anyway, it flew behind me, and it kind of circled around, shot down the trail, and it hit the back of my head, and it took my hat.
It took your hat?
Yeah, it took my hat. It was a hawk, so that was cool.
That's the coolest thing I've heard all week long. That
yeah, it was a salmon color hat, and I saw it. It went off to my right, and it flew into the trees. And
then that was it. He was just gone.
I didn't get the hat back. No, yeah.
Wow. I mean, what would be amazing is if at some point in the future that hat resurfaced from someone who was doing the trail, or like we just found out, we learned something about where the hawk goes to. The hat's dropped off somewhere in Missouri, and we're like, oh, Missouri. The hawk made it to Missouri.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It's a salmon color Shawnee Peak hat.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, you know what you're on the lookout for. Snap a photo, mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com. If you find William's hat, we want it back. So wait, but the Facebook page. So you, we talked earlier. You set a goal of $2,200. You set up the Facebook page, probably anticipating a certain amount of interest and engagement. Then what happened?
It gained a lot of popularity that I was not expecting. I ended up raising over $25,000, and it wasn't like a huge jump or anything. And you know, one day. You know, something was published in a newspaper and it was all of a sudden crazy big. It was pretty gradual, and it just kind of built up and built up. And over 4 months, it got a lot of, I guess, attention and money donated, which is awesome.
What, if anything, did that do to you, Will, as you realize, like you said, you're raising even more money. That's fantastic. It also says there's that many more people who are interested and motivated by what you're doing. Did that influence you in any way? Did you spend any time kind of thinking about just how many people, in fact, you were reaching and impacting?
So at the time, throughout the whole trail, I was pretty focused on hiking, and my mom would call me, or I would call her and tell me, you know, give me an update on how much money I'd raised. And I thought it was really cool and awesome, but it didn't really have any kind of like attachment to it. I thought it was, you know, money like, wow, $25,000, you could like buy a car with that or something. But after the trail, Save One Life put up like an infographic on their social media, and it really kind of showed me where that money went and, you know, just how much influence that money had. It meant a lot more to me that I actually knew what it was doing and what I kind of raised. So on the time at the trail, I wasn't super influenced by it, but.
Yeah, makes sense. Good to be focused. And, mm-hmm. and that's the benefit of, I don't know if this would be, you know, this isn't the trail family, I suppose, your actual family, your mom, but being able to have someone who is tracking that piece of it, there's a freedom in that too, right? It like allows you as an individual to not have to worry about all that and just do the job that you had set out to do. So that's great that you had that kind of support. I think that can make a big difference when you're doing something so ambitious.
It definitely did. Yeah, I'm super appreciative that my mom, you know, took the time and put the effort into that.
I have one other question I wanted to pull from those that had come in online, and that was about how you prepared physically for all this. So we haven't talked much at all yet about hemophilia, actually, which is a good sign, I think. But I imagine you had to do some different things or make some new considerations for something this vigorous and this continuous. So what did you have to do differently? Were there different conversations with your treatment center? Take us through some of that kind of medical prep work.
Yeah, so my mom and I, we went into the HTC here in Maine, in Scarborough, and upped my dose to 4,000 units every other day, not three times a week. And so that's a bleed dose for me. So I was taking a lot more medicine to kind of offset the damage I was doing to my body every day. But to be honest, I was not at that time training, like physically, like in the kind of winter or spring up leading up to that, during quarantine, I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't running, but in the winter I was, and even before, I was definitely running and working out, and I was getting in pretty good shape, but quarantine happened and I didn't really do anything. Cause I don't know. I knew people, you know, every year they call it couch to Katahdin, cause you know, Katahdin's the northern end of the AT, and people just get up off their couches and they start hiking, you know, with no planning, and some of them make it. And so I figured, you know, if they can do it, I can do it. And, I'd already, you know, done a week long backpacking trip with my dad with no physical planning. So I knew I could do a week. And if you just take it a week at a time and stack up enough weeks, you eventually end up with 4 months and a trail done.
Any notable bleeds or hemophilia related hiccups along the way?
Yeah. Did you get to show off like infusing in front of other trail people? Were they amazed? Like, you're carrying all this factor. They don't have to carry that weight.
Yeah, I didn't show it off. I didn't really talk about raising money all that much. I just kind of went on my way. If maybe if I was at a if I was at a shelter with someone, I would, you know, kind of talk with them about stuff like that. But generally, if I was passing someone, I wouldn't talk with them. And no notable, you know, major bleeds. There were obviously a couple hiccups that I don't even remember. I just remember that there were a couple problems, and I had to infuse because I skipped a day or whatever, but nothing that really made me take a day off or do a shorter day or something. Just had to grit my teeth a couple times and get it done.
Did you find you were more diligent about your dosing and like being adherent to your treatment plan to make sure your body, you know, worked rather than being just at home and at school?
Yeah, I definitely was. I was to the T. I followed my my plan. If I look back in my logs, I'm sure it's crazy. I have like a long time of just every other day with no, you know, nothing, no discrepancies. But eventually, I built up enough strength and endurance that I could skip a day I didn't really forget. I just kind of didn't want to do it in the morning, which sometimes had problems, but luckily it usually didn't. Which I was really lucky about.
Did it change your, sorry, Patrick, to jump in, did it change your outlook on your treatment and the importance of it? I mean, did you feel good? Did your joints feel good?
Yeah, towards the end, I felt better than I ever had in my life. I felt really good, really strong. My joints were working great. There were no problems at the end, but it definitely did give me kind of a thought of, you know, I can do stuff like this if I really, you know, make sure I infuse and stick to it.
So, Will, my last question is a two-parter. The first is, how has this experience changed you? What are ways in which you just, yeah, I mean, what are ways in which you've been changed by all this is the first part of it. And then the second part is, where are you going? Like, what, where does this fit into your life? Are you looking to do more, pushing of adventure, physical limits, tie it to a cause or a fundraising effort? Or was this something you're glad you did and now you're onto another thing? So yeah, if you could tell us, like, how did this change you, and then help me understand, where does this fit into your life? Where are you going from here?
Sure. So in the beginning, I like to kind of talk about how I was 15. I hadn't really spent any major amount of time away from my parents, being alone. And so I was in the, Great Northern Woods alone with, there's no other people there. And so for the first couple of days, I saw maybe a handful of people, most of them on like boats and stuff on the lakes. But I had to really figure out how I could cope with being alone, and it was super lonely at times, but I kind of figured out how to deal with that, and that kind of, I grew as a person in that aspect, and I really learned how to deal with that. And towards the end, I kind of liked being alone, which I thought, like, oh crap, I like being alone. But I guess it's a good thing in that aspect. But yeah, I learned how to deal with it, and grew as a person because of that. And I guess I think the real hardest part of the hike was definitely being alone in the beginning. It was super hard just learning how to do that. More than anything was physically hard. It was just really hard being alone away from my parents. But to answer your question of what's next, there is more next. This winter, I think I'm going to hike the New Hampshire 48 4,000 footers. And so there's 48 4,000 footers in New Hampshire mountains. And the winter season starts December 21st and ends March 21st. So I'm thinking I'm going to do it in a single winter season. And then next summer, I am doing something, and it is definitely going to be raising money for Save One Life.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll just have to keep posted then. We'll have to keep up to date with will your, I guess, SOBO for Save One Life doesn't really apply to the future trips. So will you have like another communication hub, or you got a whole like digital world?
Yeah. Where
world
do we find you?
Think about. Yeah.
Sure. So I think next summer, I think SOBO for Save One Life will apply. But I guess we're just going to keep uploading pictures, updates, whatever, to SOBO for Save One Life. But I have an Instagram I post on, but that's not really hemophilia related. It's just for my friends to see all the cool stuff I'm doing and that kind of thing, which I can give. But it's just all hiking stuff, really.
Yeah, where can people find your hiking photos?
It's at WAddison04, my birth year, 04. I actually posted, I did like state by state posts for the AT, except in states that were like under 100 miles. I kind of grouped them together, but there is more stuff on there. But I would recommend, if you want to see AT stuff, definitely go to SOBO for Save One Life. We're not taking any of that down. And there's some hidden pictures, hidden gems in there that make me look dumb, which is awesome. But
there'll be a link in the program notes, by the way.
Awesome.
William, thank you so much for joining us. This has been really fun, and congratulations. What an achievement. And I think it's so wonderful that you have given back to your community, but also through this, you're going to have such a such an inspiring personal story about your, like, what you discovered, during this journey, and it'll propel you towards the future. I think it's really cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, and keep it up. It's like Amy said, it's inspiring, and the impact, I know that the impact that you are having is more than you know. The impact any of us ever have is more than we know. But to do something at the profile level that you're doing it is really impressive. So stay healthy, knowing that you've got all this other stuff coming up. So do stay healthy. And yeah, we'll be keeping an eye on and maybe have you back after this winter trip to talk about that.
And if anybody sees a hawk with a salmon-colored hat flying around, please contact us.
It's got Shawnee Peak on it. It's a snow hat.
Okay. All right.
Well, thanks again, and congratulations again, William, on an outstanding accomplishment. Thanks as well to Colette for her interview earlier in the episode. We're coming up to the finish, but I want to ask you real quick, Natalie and Amy, Halloween next week, we're going to have Josh Bragg on Mischief Night to talk all about it. What is your all-time favorite Halloween costume? Whoever would like to begin. That you personally have worn.
I once was a pair of dice in middle school, like out of a cardboard box. And I remember like it was so cumbersome. I remember like my little sixth grade self, like full blown pre-Arrested Development, was like, I've made a huge mistake.
Like dice hanging from the rear view mirror, or
yeah,
like,
yeah, okay. Like, and not like a dice, like a pair of dice out of cardboard. Yeah, yeah, I made a huge mistake. I wasn't cool to begin with, and like that just like it was so cumbersome, and I didn't realize I suffered from anxiety, but I did at sixth grade, and it just didn't go well.
If we could have a picture of that to put in the program notes.
I'm 100% going to text my mother right now because that's important. It's important. You can also find me on socials, and maybe I'll put it on socials.
Oh, please do. Please do. Find Amy Board. Natalie, what about for you? You ever have an experience as a set of dice before?
I never went as a set of dice, but in third grade, I thought I was too cool for school. And so I went as a trick-or-treater.
Ooh,
oh my gosh, that's
meta.
Very meta.
Yeah, my 9-year-old self was like, I want to go dressed up trick-or-treating as a trick-or-treater. So my mom made me an oversized sweatshirt with puffy paint that said trick-or-treat. I wore ghost stockings. I had my hair in either a ponytail or pigtails with like pumpkin earrings. And I was just a trick-or-treater, trick-or-treating on Halloween.
Would you say you were generally well-received as a trick-or-treater, trick-or-treating on Halloween?
I think so. I felt really cool about it. Like, when I went to school and everyone's like, what's your costume? I'm like, I'm a trick-or-treater, duh.
I feel like that would be pulled from a high school freshman or sophomore. The fact that you were in third grade blows my mind. No one is that cool and visionary in third grade.
Thanks, Amy.
You're welcome. I feel blown away.
I'll see if I can find a pic.
Great.
Well, less interestingly, I once won a Dilbert mask during a family vacation in the arcade where you get tickets and you turn it in for something. And I was like, I'll take the Dilbert mask. It was like the hardest thing to go for. I spent all week at this vacation at Woodlock Pines just going for the Dilbert mask. I won the Dilbert mask, and I went fourth or fifth grade as Dilbert for Halloween. Dilbert, everybody. And that's the memory I chose to share with you all. And on that note, that is all for this episode. Special thanks to everyone at Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited who makes this Bloodstream podcast possible. Thanks to our interview guests, Colette Koulianos and William Addison. Thank you to our presenting sponsor, Takeda, bleedingdisorders.com, to learn more about their resources and commitment. And thank you, Genentech, our segment sponsor. Visit genentechhemophilia.com for more. Leave us a rating in the Apple Store. 5 stars are preferred. 4 stars are acceptable. Don't even come near me with any of those 3-star nonsense. I won't have it. Share this episode with a friend, or share any episode of Bloodstream with a friend or an acquaintance. We covered a lot of topics. Got to have at least one friend out there who's going to find one of the topics relevant. Plus, word of mouth is the best way we reach new people. So, word that mouth. Have a bleeding disorder or healthcare topic that you'd like to hear us discuss more? Want to inquire about casting opportunities for Bloodstream's narrative and docu-styled podcast series, such as the Pain Podcast? Just running out of great places to send emails? Well, we've got you covered. Email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. Connect with Bloodstream Media on social media. Bloodstream's on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or you can follow Amy Borden, Natalie Lynch, or Patrick James Lynch on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Shout out to all the committed LinkedIn users out there. Check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreammedia.com, where you'll find links and information related to the stories and segments featured on this episode. I'm your host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I am your other host, Amy Board.
And I'm Natalie Lynch. Sometimes I'm your host, too.
That's true. And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.